I apologize in advance because I haven't my text reviewed by a native English speaker, but I'll try to read it in an intelligible way. So one of the central aims of Merleau-Ponty's phenomenology of perception, in my view, is to formulate a radically new conception of subjectivity. The latter corresponds, as is well known, to the idea of embodied subjectivity, to the so-called lived body. What has hitherto received less attention is the connection between the idea of the lived body and Merleau-Ponty's explicit theory of the cogito in the phenomenology of perception. In this presentation, I will try to draw the connection between these two notions, the lived body and what he calls the tacit cogito, and show that, to a certain extent, the two can be seen as identical. But first of all, what is the lived body? What does it mean? The concept of the lived body can be read as establishing a middle path between what Merleau-Ponty calls intellectualist and empiricist accounts of subjectivity. Just like intellectualists, Merleau-Ponty thinks that subjectivity cannot be reduced to objective processes seen from a third-person perspective, processes occurring in the brain. His position is not equivalent to that of empiricists, though. Against empiricists, Merleau-Ponty emphasizes the role our body plays in opening us to the world, the role our body has in creating or producing meaning in the world around us. In other words, he emphasizes the fact that our body cannot be accounted for in purely mechanistic terms, as it were a mere thing. The lived body exhibits and creates sense or meaning, and in this sense, it can be seen as taking the place of what traditionally was called the subject. So, for Merleau-Ponty, the lived body is like a kind of sort of proto-subject. It corresponds to an elementary form of subjectivity upon which all other more complex forms that involve language are built and ultimately go back to. As a rudimentary form of awareness, the lived body accomplishes our most primitive contact with being and with the world. Merleau-Ponty's lived body seems to be, in fact, a new version of what Sartre called the pre-reflexive cogito. For both Merleau-Ponty and Sartre, all consciousness involves some form of self-awareness. However, it does not imply that consciousness involves explicit reflection upon oneself. So this form of self-awareness does not involve an explicit reflection. Sartre first presented this idea in his first essay, The Transcendence of the Ego. There he has shown that the field of consciousness is impersonal and the ego itself is a transcendent object for consciousness, for the pre-reflexive consciousness. An object generated by explicit reflection of consciousness upon itself. Thus, in that essay, Sartre presents consciousness as being anonymous. And this is precisely one of the features of Sartre's first theory of subjectivity that seems to interest Merleau-Ponty the most. As we indicated, in Merleau-Ponty's thought, the lived body as such appears to occupy the same function of Sartre's impersonal field of consciousness. This can be seen when Merleau-Ponty says that the lived body is an anonymous entity, which is best described by the French pronoun on, which in English I think it means one. instead of I, it's one. In order to account for pathological experiences like that of the phantom arm, Merleau-Ponty relies on the idea that the body is not the object of an immediate or instantaneous apprehension. Besides the momentary awareness I have of my body, my present awareness, there is a habitual phenomenon of the body. This can make me be aware of members I presently don't dispose of, like the phantom arm. I quote, correlatively, my body must be grasped not merely in an instantaneous, singular, and full experience, but moreover, under an aspect of generality and as an impersonal being. Merleau-Ponty relies on Freud's concept of repression to explain that the lived body is like an innate complex, inasmuch as it functions as a primordial past that I can never fully, or that the subject can never fully overcome, and giving shape to all my life's moments and constituting my primordial attachment to the world. For me to follow a certain personal course of action, I must have previously adhered to a world in general through the anonymous existence of my body. In parallel to the description of our lived body as a pre-personal entity, Merleau-Ponty describes perception itself as an anonymous event. He says that, and I quote, every perception takes place within an atmosphere of generality and is presented to us as anonymous, end of quote. If we wanted to put perceptual experience into words, we should say that, and I quote again, one perceives in me and not that I perceive, end of quote. Merleau-Ponty's meaning here is that perception is not entirely in my command. Perception expresses, as he puts it, a given situation, whereas personal acts express my personal choices. I can choose not to open my eyes, but once I have opened them, I cannot choose not to see. He even compares sensation to a birth and a death, in the sense that although we all born and die, birth and death are events that certainly concern us, we can never live them through from a first personal perspective. In these words, birth and death are pre-personal horizons of our life. Sensation points beyond itself to an outer object, but the latter is not recognized by me, understood as a disembodied or as a transcendental subject, but rather it is understood by me taken as a lived body that espouses the sensible thing. Since sensation comes, as it were, from beneath me, from a region of my being which is not fully under my control, sensation precludes my experience from being transparent to itself. Through my sensibility, I am open to sensible things. I do not constitute them or create them in accordance with certain abstract notions. The things that strike my senses are not of my creation. In order to perceive them, I have to be synchronized with them, as it were. Merleau-Ponty says that I, as a body, am born together with them. To sense implies not only that things outside me strike my senses, but that my body somehow takes a proper attitude to be able to perceive each of them. I don't create the sensation of blue or red, but in order to perceive those colors, my body must learn to take on the attitude of seeing blue or seeing red as a response to what, until that point, is only a vague solicitation. My body must already be somehow familiar with entities I perceive through the senses for me to be able to perceive them. This means that before I'm able to take myself as a conscious, thinking subject, the body has always already opened itself to a world where sensible beings can be found. It is true that a synthesis of the object is required in order to perceive it. However, contrary to what the intellectualist tradition holds, that synthesis is performed not by me as a subject or as a transcendental subject, but by me as taken as a lived body. It is not a synthesis that I perform whenever I presently perceive something. Rather, it is much more akin to an ability of the body, to a know-how that must be learned and practiced. It is this knowledge that is brought, knowledge, under quotes, that is brought into play whenever I come before things in order to perceive them. Merleau-Ponty says that perception benefits from work already completed, from a general synthesis constituted once and for all. This is what, and I quote Merleau-Ponty, I express by saying that I perceive with my body or with my senses. My body and my senses being precisely this habitual knowledge of the world, this implicit or sedimented science. End of quote. The fact that my body makes use of this implicit and sedimented knowledge also entails that perceptual knowledge remains always, to a certain extent, opaque. There is always more to know of the objects we see with our eyes and feel with our hands. For example, their hidden profiles. In sum, and I quote again, if, as we have said, every perception has something anonymous about it, this is because it takes up an acquisition that it does not question. The perceiving person is not spread out before himself in a manner that the consciousness must be. He has an historical thickness, he takes up a perceptual tradition, and is confronted with the present. End of quote. If I could be aware of my first perception, it would appear to me as an iteration of a previous grasp of the world, or, as Merleau-Ponty says, of a primordial pact between my body and the world. Besides its anonymous character, the lived body takes the place of the subject in that it cannot be fully turned into an object, and constantly eludes my efforts to grasp it as such. In fact, although the lived body is in some sense aware of itself, or else it wouldn't be a lived body, it can never become an object for me. It is precisely that through which there can be objects in the first place. To the extent that the lived body is a condition of the possibility of my being aware of anything whatsoever, it fulfills a transcendental role in perception. Contrary to objects whose presence presupposes their possible absence, the lived body is always present for me. The permanence of the lived body cannot be equated with a de facto necessity. Merleau-Ponty goes as far as saying that this permanence is a metaphysical necessity. Although the lived body is present in all our perceptions and movements, this permanence functions as the thematic background of whatever comes into our thematic focus of attention. Even when I try to turn my body into an object by touching myself, the body taken as a lived body always eludes this transformation. As my left hand touches my right one, the former is not present for me as an object. They exchange positions. Either I focus on the left hand or on the right one. The elusiveness of the lived body mirrors the elusiveness that is traditionally ascribed to the subject of knowing. Another of the features of the lived body is the fact that even though it possesses some sort of reflexivity, it is not closed in on itself. Rather, it is primordially outside of itself in the world. The intentionality of the lived body is, as Merleau-Ponty puts it, transcendence towards the world. Perception is precisely the act by which the lived body is not only in contact with the world, but also and primordially with itself. This means that, at least in the phenomenology of perception, Merleau-Ponty does not relinquish the Cartesian cogito. but rather radically reformulates it. Merleau-Ponty's idea of the cogito consists, as I will show, precisely in the self-assurance of my perception of the world. According to Merleau-Ponty, there is thus an element of truth in Descartes' return to subjectivity. This element can be translated by the fact that perception by its nature is self-aware. But instead of being in full possession of itself or being transparent to itself, it escapes itself towards the thing perceived. The thing perceived cannot be severed from perception. They cannot be split apart. Seeing is not, as Descartes held, mere thinking of seeing. If I doubt the thing perceived, I must put perception into question as well. Therefore, the certainty that accrues to perception is equivalent to the certainty I have of the thing perceived. This does not imply that we have absolute certainty of the thing perceived. We are always exposed to the possibility of error. The latter, however, presupposes our primary contact with the world, our being in the world. We can only doubt this or that particular perception inasmuch as we already find ourselves in the world. What Merleau-Ponty's version of the cogito ultimately points to is the transcendence of the body towards the world. This theory of the cogito, Merleau-Ponty's theory or version of the cogito, also has consequences regarding the possibility of self-knowledge. Since we are not in possession of ourselves, we are not transparent to ourselves, talk of a higher or lesser degree of self-knowledge is to a certain extent legitimate. This does not mean that what falls short of our self-knowledge is some kind of mysterious unconscious, like, for example, the Freudian unconscious. We are always in a state of being disclosed to ourselves, even though this disclosedness remains ambiguous, and we can thus fail to comprehend ourselves. For example, we can harbor feelings towards someone in a way that is not totally clear to ourselves what they mean. But more importantly, as was already the case with our openness to the world, deception regarding ourselves is certainly possible, but we cannot be absolutely wrong in this regard. We cannot be absolutely wrong regarding ourselves. I can doubt what I know or think I know about me, in particular what concerns my inner life, my thoughts, wills, and feelings, because I am somehow certain of my very own doubt. Absolute doubt regarding myself would be self-contradictory. Taken to the limit, it would imply doubting my own doubt. However, contrary to the Cartesian model, for Merleau-Ponty, consciousness, or at least consciousness at its pre-reflective level, is akin to an action. I can only be certain that I want something, love something, or perceive something if, in fact, I accomplish my existence in such a manner. The certainty I have of my thoughts stems from their actual existence, from their actual accomplishment. For this reason, talk of inner perception is to a certain extent inadequate. At the most fundamental level, I am not an object for observation. I find myself only in the intentional act in the broad sense, in wishing, perceiving, wanting, etc. Inner perception or reflection is not clear for me what extent Merleau-Ponty distinguishes between the inner perception or reflection. Comes only later and wouldn't be possible if I wasn't aware of my intentional act towards an object. After denying that the cogito is identical to itself in the so-called inner perception, Merleau-Ponty proceeds to show that self-coincidence or self-possession cannot be found in the realm of pure thought either. He tries to show this by analyzing the nature of geometrical truth, but here I cannot enter into much detail concerning this. suffice it to say that the supposed self-coincidence is an illusion that masks the expressive and creative nature of all truth. According to Merleau-Ponty, thought cannot exist apart from language, and the latter, language, results from the lived body's expressive character. It is one of the ways the body, language, it is one of the ways the body has of producing sense or meaning. In its inception, language does not have the function of representing a pre-existing thought as if it was its mere garment. The expressive nature of language entails that true thought always transcends pre-established meanings. When it is fully accomplished, the linguistic process of expression has the ability of creating new meanings out of established ones. The fact that the ability to say I or I think is mediated through language is one reason more for the fact that we must remain opaque to ourselves, that we don't fully coincide with ourselves. We have decentered subjectivity. For we can never manage to put language in total transparency before us. If by nature all its meanings are ambiguous, that is, on the one hand, they are acquired and inherited, and on the other hand, they harbor the possibility of pointing beyond themselves to new meanings. This is what happens, according to Merleau-Ponty, in poetry, where the use of language, poetry takes acquired meanings and, so to speak, dislocates them to produce new meanings. As a consequence of his theory of language, thought, and subjectivity, Merleau-Ponty puts into question the unconditioned character of the Cartesian cogito, its supposed lack of presuppositions. He points out in this regard that the cogito that appears in Descartes' second meditation belongs to every human being that is capable of reflection. In that sense, it belongs to no one in particular. It is a second-hand cogito. The cogito's true formula, according to Merleau-Ponty, is one thinks, one is. In fact, Descartes' cogito is already a product of expression and presupposes the acquisition of language. Descartes and we, who follow his thoughts in the second meditation, tend to overlook this precisely because language and expression tend to be effaced in favor of its product, in this case in favor of the I think, whereas the latter, the I think, is merely what Merleau-Ponty calls a spoken cogito. Not that this is what Descartes wanted to convey. He actually had in view that silent presence of myself to myself, but he missed this target. When we are focused in reading Descartes, we perform the Cartesian cogito by saying, I am, I think, I am a thinking being, but we leave out of account the phenomenon of our innermost subjectivity. The cogito in Descartes' hands becomes a cultural object like any other. However, this does not mean, as post-structuralism would have it, that the cogito is a product of language, and for that reason, an illusion. I could even start to read or understand Descartes if I had not, in a pre-predicative, pre-reflexive manner, an awareness of my life as my own, of my own life as mine. If the spoken cogito ultimately didn't refer to a tacit cogito. I will
stop here. I think it provides the idea.
Thank you, Beres. So that gives me an opportunity. Thank you.